Faith Uncut, a podcast where we explore faith in ways that might get you kicked out of most churches. I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
And today we're discussing what do we do with the Bible?
Dun, 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 dun.
So this is something that's been on my mind for a while. It actually came up in a discussion in a group, and we had already had a show planned about it, so it actually worked out. The timing worked out. Okay, so the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Collection of 66 books. There's lots of ways that people think about it, but in traditional Christian circles, some of the ways that I've heard is that it's the greatest love story ever told. It's the story of God redeeming the creation. It's a God-inspired book that, you know, that's straight from God, and the Bible is God, depending on how you read John.
Woo chow.
The first chapter of John.
Okay.
So it's a lot of things.
I see it as a history book.
Okay.
Yeah, as a history book, as a guideline for human interaction and human relationships.
Okay.
I do think that it's an excellent story, a greatest story ever told. I mean, okay. But I definitely see it as a history companion source. Mm-hmm. Certain things can be verified. Certain things still look elusive, and they might be elusive due to literary license. You know, somebody taking license with details or whatever, but it is a lot of things.
Yeah, so I look at the Bible as a collection of literature that kind of shows us the utility and power of story.
Yeah.
So
ooh, I like that.
Story is incredibly important for human beings.
Mm-hmm.
You look at a situation like Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico, where 3,057 people were killed.
Mm-hmm.
That number is difficult to envision how devastating that is. But each one of those numbers is a life. And it is not until you start telling the story of those lives that we're able to connect.
That the magnitude.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So the Bible is this collection of different stories telling different things. So it's telling stories of how a nation was created, or how God affirms that nation, or it describes victories. It reframes historical events.
Mm-hmm.
You think about the way things are spun in the news. The Bible has some of that. It has. It provides hope as you go through. The
Inspiration.
Bible, the Bible does a lot of things, and it does them all through different stories told by different people.
Yep.
And I used to subscribe to this idea that it was one unifying story. And the more that I started reading the Bible, the more ridiculous of a notion I saw that to be. There's no way that all of this is telling the same story.
Right.
So they're trying to tell similar stories.
Mm-hmm.
So for instance, there's the story in Exodus is the story of how the Hebrews escaped slavery.
Yes.
Okay. And so you have all of these wonderful events called plagues. And
not wonderful events.
No, fantastic events that would be cinematic, and it would be amazing
it
to
was
see
blood in the river.
Right. So you see all of these plagues, and then you see a nation of enslaved people, well, a group of enslaved people escaping slavery, and then beginning to and becoming a nation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's one story of the Exodus. There's another story of the Exodus in the story of Joseph. Now Joseph is the son of Jacob, and he has these brothers, and the brothers, so the brothers, Joseph had this dream that he was going to be great, and the brothers were going to bow down to him, and he told the brothers this story. First of all, who does that? That doesn't even make sense. So he tells the brothers a story, like, y'all going to bow down to me. So they get upset.
Joseph was probably
and they throw him into this cistern all by himself, and he's there to die. After they took, you know, his coat that he had. And then, you know, Joseph is rescued and into slavery. Then he goes into, in that slavery, he's accused of rape, and then he has to leave out of the house. He runs out of the house, and he ends up in jail in the palace. And then he ends up through a series of events, and, his, and him being able to interpret these dreams ends up being in, you know, a high position in that. That's also the Exodus story. So you have one version of events that people want to look at and say this is historically accurate, but not really. It's not. It's not historically accurate. And the reason why, you know, is because that 10th plague is the plague of where God just wipes out all of the firstborn of Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And the Egyptian hieroglyphs have nothing about this. That is incredibly odd.
Right, unlikely.
That a culture that was that meticulous.
Right, failed to mention.
Failed to mention that. The equivalent is waking up on September 12th, 2001, and the New York Times not mentioning 9/11 at all.
At all, yeah.
So we have to interrogate, you know, what is this? It's intended to tell a story of escaping from slavery, which is what the Joseph story does. So Joseph is one of, he represents one of the 12 tribes of Israel, which is, he has these brothers. And the South is always like, the tribe of Judah is always like the favorite tribe or whatever. And so the brothers kind of kick him out. He ends up in slavery. He ends up in, you know, in slavery to Potiphar, and then he ends up in jail. And that's also telling the progression of Israel out of slavery.
Right. And liberation
the,
story.
The story of Joseph is written as a novel to also communicate the same story that's in the Exodus. It's just using different characters. It's another writer using literary form to say, hey, this is another way we can tell it, because we really like this story.
Creative
just like
license.
Americans seem to tell World War II stories in every imaginable way because they liked the story. The story of the Exodus was also popular, and people told that in so many ways. So the Bible is it uses story to do a lot of that. And so it starts to challenge us as we accept notions like this. Like, for me, I always have to ask, like, what am I reading? Am I reading a version of a story? Am I reading, you know, characters displaced to tell a larger story? Am I reading someone's poetry? Am I reading, like, that's important for me to ask, because I can't be like, oh, scriptures, God inspired all of this, God did all this, because that's not really how that, that's not really how that works. That doesn't, so let's say you inspired me to write a song. I was just so inspired by your eyes or your voice or whatever. Right. And I was like, yo, I'm gonna do it. You didn't tell me to write the song.
I sure didn't.
You didn't write the song.
No, I did not.
All you did was serve as the inspiration, which is an incredible gift. You're the muse for what I end up writing. And writers wrote with God as the muse.
Right.
And they told different stories about their lives. And they gathered these stories together. These stories were gathered together at different councils and were included into this book.
Right. Put together as a cohesive unit and put and presented as this book.
But every story in that book is written with intention. So, first of all, it's not even close to the time when it's writing. So you could write a story about your day today and you'll have more detail in it. But if you were writing a story about something that happened to you 30 years ago, that's going to be a different type of story.
Exactly.
What you're going to have to do is start this by saying, what type of story, or what do I want to tell? What story do I want to tell? And so you'll leave out things that don't, so it's not, it doesn't end up being a historical record. You know, Amira came in and shut the door and took off her coat. And I was, no, that's not part of the story. You're telling the parts of the story that are relevant.
Right.
Now, we are reading books that are like 3,000 to up to 5,000 years old.
Yes.
Okay. Imagine, it's, take the low end. Let's take 3,000 years.
Okay.
Imagine you were writing a story. How relevant do you think that story would be in the year 5019?
Good Lord.
Like, how would you speak to the issues that are going on in 5019? Would that even be in your consciousness as you're writing your story?
Not necessarily, but if I'm writing about a God-inspired interaction with humankind, and then I'm also giving thought to what those interactions make the humans say and do to one another. I think that's when stories take on a more timeless characteristic, because certain things are just unique to the human condition. And I think this speaks to the intelligence of man. It's just that we understand that, you know, even this concept of love, it's something that we've observed. You know, does it affect animals the way that it affects us? You know, do they force themselves, or do they pair off, and are they just together all the time? Now, through our scientific inquisitiveness, we've seen that there are some species who do that. And then there are some species who just don't. They are different, and it fits this idea that mankind is at the highest level of iteration of God's image on earth. So we have this higher intelligence that says that we have emotional intelligence as well as technical intelligence. And we're able to consider, I wonder how this aspect of relationship or self-development or enlightenment, you know, will affect not only me, but my generations. I think that's something that we think about, mm-hmm. you know?
So it's important to keep in mind as you look back at these stories to imagine what they would be like looking forward that far.
Mm-hmm.
Stories that they wrote had a primary audience, and those were the people who would be reading the stories around that time.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's secondary and tertiary audiences. Those are us that, yeah. that end up reading the stories. But if you're writing your story or a story that's important to you, let's say the story was about relationships that you formed through social media. That's not going to be relevant in 5019.
Nope.
So you're telling elements of your story to the primary audience. You're not thinking about the 5019 audience that's right. going to be. So some of those things may not apply, but there are other things that will apply.
Right.
So these are the timeless concepts that you're mentioning.
Exactly.
So this is God and love and relationships yep. with humans and yep. what happened to us and yep. things like that.
Yep.
Those are the things that last.
Mm-hmm.
It's very important to understand that these things last, but you can't build doctrine off of everything that's here.
Oh, that's
because
true.
5019 is not going to care about Facebook or Twitter or whatever. Like mm-mm. that's just not going to be part of it.
No.
So that's kind of how I approached the Bible I'm not saying God wrote it. God didn't write it. God inspired it. They were inspired by God. And that is, I appreciate that.
Right.
I've been inspired and God is worth being inspired mm-hmm, by.
Mm-hmm. But even that's not unique. So we've talked about this, mm-hmm. but I'm not trying to cut you off.
Go ahead.
But just to add depth to that last comment, that God is inspiring and I'm glad that he inspired this body of work.
Mm-hmm.
That is not even unique to Christians.
Mm-hmm.
Every group, every, should we call them ethnic groups, but even ancient peoples have mm-hmm. a story,
yes.
some sort of cohesive, common basis
mm-hmm.
from which they begin to define their own world and their own experience.
Okay.
So that's not necessarily unique to Christianity, but it is something that shows up in other places. So like when you talk about Egyptian, the fact that they had a written system of language in the hieroglyphs, you also have stories housed in these ancient, you know, renderings of writings mm-hmm. where people are talking about where their people came from, what was important to them. If anything, I think this is a great study into sociology in that over time we've deduced down what are the major themes. Like your point regarding will social media be the thing that people understand in the year 59, whatever? Not necessarily, but it was also a system of community.
Mm-hmm.
So we can understand system of community mm-hmm. across time because that's basically what society is.
Yeah.
So you found yourself operating within society. There's going to be a hierarchy. In the Old Testament, we're talking about hierarchies that, at least in the Exodus story, at the top are the Egyptians, and at the top of that is a pharaoh,
mm-hmm.
a king. That can resonate across time because this is how humans were beginning to organize their societies. There's going to be at least one, either one supreme, you know, type of leader or a leading family, a leading class that has been, you know, bestowed upon to kind of, you know, be over this group of people. That's how we continue to relate. So, okay.
I agree with you. I think that that's important. And so along those lines, you can be able to read that story and pull out those relationships
mm-hmm.
and how they work.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also need something else. So for instance, you're writing that story that's being read in 5019 and you say Facebook. And 5019 is going, maybe they think it's a book of faces. It takes someone who actually knows what was going on during
history.
That time to come back and say, hey, listen, that was actually this social network that they
right.
use or whatever. So that's why learning and education matters when we're reading
mm-hmm.
some of the stuff. Some of the Words stuff you can just pull
things.
Out directly, and then other things you may need
you have
you know,
to
explanation.
Infer.
This is a cultural thing that they actually meant. Like we say things in culture all the time
right.
that will not play 30 and 40 years from now.
Which is why we critique the Bible the way that we do, because we're very careful to, or we critique things here on the show, of course, but we critique the Bible in general because we have to consider that culture
mm-hmm.
then was different. You know, there yeah. were certain things that were allowed and not allowed. And, you know, why does a passage read this way? Well, of course, it's going to be written this way because of who wrote it. You
yeah.
know what I mean?
Yeah.
And who had access to being able to read and write and interpret, and who had that trusted position in society to speak to other people. When you talk about secondary and tertiary audiences, so there's one person who reads it, then there's another person who hears it, and then there's another person who interprets it.
Mm-hmm.
So That's like me going to church and then my child did not go. And I turn around and I tell them what I learned. And then my child turns around to their peer and is like, my mom told me X, Y, and Z. That's like a crazy game of telephone. Mm-hmm. But I was in the audience. The person who actually saw the words, I don't know if they skipped over something. We've talked about this as far as people hearing, you know, the word versus actually reading it and realizing, whoa, you know, I did not know these gaps in the delivery of the information.
Right. So then what can we do with this book? Because it's so diverse in its composition, you can use the Bible to tell the story of liberation, like we mentioned with Exodus and the Joseph story. Mm-hmm. I really think everyone should just go and just do that exercise, because Joseph is the story of Exodus, and you'll see it like in Pharaoh. Like,
I'm fascinated. I'm going to do it tonight.
Yeah, because Joseph was enslaved in Potiphar's house. Potiphar was an Egyptian. He's an Egyptian because they enslaved out. So anyway, all of that lines up. Like, you just replace the characters with what happened in the Exodus story. Mm-hmm, it works. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you can tell the story of your liberation. You can use it to justify the colonization. So
I feel like the umbrella is you can use it for both positive and negative things. Now let's go down this list.
Let's go down the list.
Okay.
Israel's liberate, or Hebrew nation.
A liberation
is liberated
story. Mm-hmm.
Through the story of Exodus.
Mm-hmm.
And then they colonized Canaan.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and this is
y'all,
why
I'm in class right now. Cool.
This is why it's important to look at the different elements of. That actually comes from a Native American theologian, Robert Warrior, that says, yeah, what about Canaan? Like, they didn't do anything to deserve that.
Exactly.
They just had land and they were living and being fine.
Gentrification.
And then this other group of people just come in and they say, is God just making them do this? And they just take over this land and kill us. Like, what did we do? So you can use the Bible in multiple ways, like you said. So you can support capitalism with the Bible. Yeah.
Yeah, you can.
You can justify slavery with the Bible in lots of places.
Yep.
You can do a lot of stuff. You can use it to show how God chooses leaders.
Mm-hmm.
You had the story of Saul where Israel wanted a king. God's like, you don't need kings. You got me. And they said, we want a king. He was like, all right, cool. Y'all can have this one. This is the one they wanted. Saul, right. You want him? He's tall. He's handsome. Hey, you can have him. They said, yeah, sure. That's a king. He's nice, good looking, whatever. That's one way God chooses kings. Another way God chooses kings is through sexual assault. This is crazy. So they chose Saul as king.
Yes.
Now, the next king ended up being David.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But there were two kings. Isbosheth was the second king. He was Saul's son.
Okay.
So there was this, like, think about it like a prophet or advisor or whatever. Think about like your chief of staff in the White House.
Right.
His name's Abner. Now, Saul has died, and he had a wife or a concubine named Rizpah. Abner appoints Isbosheth. I think I'm mangling that name, but whatever.
Mm-hmm.
He appoints him as king. Now, David is the other king, so the nation is divided. Israel accuses Abner of sleeping with Saul's concubine, Rizpah. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the way the dynamics are set up, like, the person, the king who has the wives and the concubines is responsible for protecting them all.
Yes.
And if that king cannot protect them, then there's a challenge to the king. It's almost like someone else is sitting on the throne. So when he's accusing Abner of sleeping with Rizpah, that becomes this huge offense.
Mm-hmm.
And so Abner, the person who anointed him king or appointed him king, is now like, nah, I ain't dealing with you no more. I'm going to make David king. So because of this situation with Rizpah, who is a voiceless actor in here, David ends up uniting all of Israel. He was just the king in the south. He was just the king of Judah. But because of this assault now, Rizpah didn't have any. She's concubines are obtained like through war and stuff like that. This is not like a marriage of choice or anything like that. So,
spoils of war.
So you got one case where Saul is the king just by being chosen, and then you got another case where David becomes the king because Abner is accused of sleeping with the concubine who probably did not consent to that.
Right.
And then there's a warring faction in the house, and that's Saul's rightful son doesn't become the king now because Abner decided to do something else. Because
he's beefing.
So. The Bible is used to do lots of interesting things. I mean, you can use it, and it has been used for all of that. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Those are some of the things that we can do with it.
Yeah.
We could justify any position that we want with it.
Anything. That's because the Bible is, in, like you said, it is intentional. And in the telling of these stories, it raises different perspectives.
Yeah.
Like when I learned through Bible study, the unique way that David came to be Bathsheba's husband, mm-hmm. and the fact that it is most likely her voice speaking to her son Solomon about what is a good woman. When you consider how they got together, it's not so much that she was working within her own agency, like, oh, the king notices me, now I'm gonna be with the king. If anything, it highlights that the king has a certain level of power to which he basically said, hey, go get her for me.
Mm-hmm.
I need to holler at her. The way that the scripture presents it does not present it as if, I don't think she fought him off as much as she might have recognized that when the king calls for you, you go to him. Mm-hmm. You are not in a position to reject him or reject his advances. But what did it do? It put David in the position of relieving himself of a romantic rival who didn't even know that he had a rival. Mm-hmm. And when you look at how calculating he was to bring about the death of Uriah, it is just like that did not absolve him from the mark of murdering him, mm-hmm. because he went so far out of his way to do it. Now, David being in the bloodline of Jesus, obviously he's mission critical to the whole entire, you know, cohesiveness of the story. But then it's like, you look at him, you're like, yo, you was like wilding. You went from being like the little kid who killed Goliath to like this crazy power hungry king.
Mm-hmm.
But somewhere, so I see that and I'm like, look at him. You know what I mean? This is what I'm saying. But then it's like Bathsheba wasn't moving in a Jezebel spirit, but then it gives you this opportunity to see how God even deals with the people that he's put in power.
Right. So yeah, you can see stuff like that through the text. And those are the nuggets that we can glean from these stories that are being told. Part of the problem is the stories are being told by different people. It's easy to understand how you would get messed up with. So let's say, for instance, Kings and Chronicles, they telling the same information for different reasons. The writers had different intents when they were writing. Same thing with the Gospels. The reason why I used to get so bent out of shape when I was like this heavy Christian apologist, because I was like, no, there's no contradiction in the Bible. It all is unified or whatever. That's not really the way it goes. It's not.
Yeah.
So like what happens in the Gospels, like they thought that Jesus was coming back like soon, because Jesus was like, yeah, I'll be back. And so they like, cool, it's going to happen. He said before the end of the age. So they like, it's happening before we die. Right. I'll be there in 5 minutes, just like Lazarus. Everybody dies. So anyway, they thought Jesus was coming back soon. And so nobody wrote anything, because why? Jesus is coming back.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until Jesus didn't come back when they expected him that stories started to proliferate through the people, and they were saying, well, Jesus did this, well, I heard Jesus did this, and so now you got all of these differing accounts, and some people's like, hold on, no, we got to straighten this out.
Mm-hmm.
And so Mark sits down and writes an account of the life and ministry of Jesus Christ, Jesus of Nazareth. So this is 30 years after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
Now the other gospel writers came, and like in some cases you see kind of, it seems like they're copying off each other's paper, but like they're telling stories about Jesus. They're all trying to correct the narrative about Jesus because the narrative is getting away from them. It's getting out of their control. Mm-hmm. And so that's why you see differences in the genealogies in Matthew and Luke, because they're telling different stories. And so when you have multiple writers writing stories, of course they're not going to all line up.
Mm-hmm.
But even sometimes when you have the same writer writing whatever it is, it doesn't line up. The famous example is Proverbs 24, verse 4 and verse 5.
Mm-hmm.
Verse 4, do not answer fools according to their folly, or you will be a fool yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if you see somebody that's a fool, don't answer, don't even talk, don't even engage with them, because you're going to look like a fool.
Yeah.
Verse 5, answer fools according to their folly, or they will be wise in their own eyes. You should correct that person because they're going to think they're smart and they're not. Same writer, opposing views, back to back.
One sentence right after the other.
So what I'm saying is, like, you can use the Bible to make any point you want to make. Mm-hmm. Now, should you do that?
No.
Okay. That's the things we can't do with the Bible. Like, we can't claim things about it that it does not claim about itself. Mm-hmm. The Bible does not claim it doesn't have any errors. Of course it has errors. Especially if you're trying to make the case that it's all one thing. Yeah, if you're making that case, there's tons of errors.
Yep.
If you're making the case that this is a collection of books, maybe I got Alice Walker, I got James Baldwin, I got, you know, Zora Neale Hurston, mm-hmm. I got Michael Crichton, I got all of these things telling the story. Why would I expect them to line up? That's not what it's about. This is a collection. Mm-hmm. So you run into that issue of dealing with these errors when you're making the unified case. You don't run into them when you make it because it's easy to explain away.
Right.
The one story thing is a little odd because it would mean that the Hebrew or the Jewish writers would somehow be writing a Christian redemption story. Mm-hmm. Now we have to ask, is that really what they, do we think that that's what they were doing in Genesis, Exodus, in the Torah, all the way through Deuteronomy, and then mm-hmm. through the annals, through the Chronicles and Kings and Ruth and Judges and all that stuff? Do we think that they were writing about Jesus Christ and the things that Jesus did during his ministry? If that were the case, then you would expect that the people who believe those Old Testament stories would also believe all of the New Testament stories, mm-mm. but that's not what we find.
Nope.
So the one story idea is, it falls down on the fact that, you know, you don't believe it. Everyone doesn't believe it all as one story.
Right.
And they still get tremendous utility out of it. Like, right. There's a lot of information there, which I believe that the Bible is useful for. Like we said, like, you still have things that you can get. There's things you can learn about humans and nature. And
I definitely think that we, at least from the Christian side, from the Christianity side, you end up finding utility for the Old Testament because it is foundational. And then when you take the Old and New Testament together, at least my understanding is, it's explaining how we went from A to B, like literally how we got from point A to point B. And if you are, I don't claim to be the most studious, but I do see it as one of those, as we developed into a complex community, as we developed into a complex society, it occurred to certain leaders, prophets, thinkers, the intellectuals of their day, mm-hmm. that there would be a further manifestation of what God would come to be to the expanding group that is known as his people. Mm-hmm. It's saying something's coming and everybody might not understand what that is, but I'm going to lend thought, words, creative license to what I believe that is. Mm-hmm. And then in the New Testament, when it reaches back, it's like, this is who y'all was talking about. You know, this is who you were waiting for. You end up losing certain people because they're like, mm-mm, mm-hmm. nuh-uh, that's not it. But I had said before, and I don't know if this is particularly intellectual, isn't that, might just be my little, you know, myopic understanding. But I definitely see the connectivity between the Torah, the New Testament as the Christian Bible, and the Quran. I see them as three different distinct iterations of God talking to ultimately his people. And it has filtered down into three distinct different ways that these groups honor and worship an all-powerful God. So from the Torah to that Christian Bible, but then understanding, and I'm not really I would never claim to be a student of the Quran, but I do see the idea that they can see Jesus as a prophet, and that it is a huge misunderstanding that they hate mm-hmm. the idea of a Christ. That is not true.
Right.
And they do speak to the fact that there was a Christ and he was a prophet who was sent to speak on things and to offer a hope until, mm-hmm. you know, God spoke again to his people. When he spoke again, it became the Quran. Mm-hmm. Now, for people who can take the longer view. And I that makes sense to me historically, too, because mm-hmm. as language and culture and ritual develop, then you have people trying to make sense of, well, why do y'all fry y'all chicken in vegetable oil and we fry our chicken in olive oil? You understand what I'm saying? Yeah. And across the telling of stories, you realize that, oh, well, once upon a time there was a famine and that time was, you know, in the time of Herod. And they're like, who? Because that was before the real manifestation of their own tradition. Yeah. So they say, oh, okay, well, that makes sense to me because, duh, there used to be, you know, the resources that provided this in this land, and we've continued to evolve.
Yeah.
So I see it as a bridge.
So it makes sense that you sit. First of all, who fries chicken and olive oil? They got money. Like, that's olive oil is expensive. Like, I wouldn't be, okay, I'm not wasting up my good olive oil on chicken. I got,
I mean,
bacon
not your
right
extra
there.
Version, but like your light olive oil, you can get a nice little fry off of that. But okay. That's not what this show is about.
Okay,
go
I'm
ahead.
Sorry. So the reason why it can sit that way and that can be true is because you have people who are writing story, you have human beings,
mm-hmm.
and this is important. You don't want to take their humanity away. You don't want to say they're not a good writer because God gave them all the
information.
These are some brilliant writers.
Yeah.
If you see what they're doing with the language, if you see what they're doing with the literary form, do not take that away from those writers. So you have human writers writing stories about God and relationships with people and how we should treat each other and mm-hmm. what they observe in life and what happened to them in both the Old Testament, the New Testament, and the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
And in those traditions, they actually share a common history. So
exactly,
everything looks the same. Their history kind of diverges at Abraham with the Sarah and Hagar story.
Mm-hmm.
But all of that makes sense to me.
Right.
That feels right. Another thing that we cannot do with the Bible, especially because of the way we've already described it, you cannot use this to oppress people, because the moment that you try to use it to oppress people, you're going to get it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to pull out a proof text, which is you can't do that with the Bible. You're going to pull out a text mm-hmm. and then you're going to go according to that text and you're going to harm a lot of people. And then someone's going to say, hey, did you look at this text over here?
Mm-hmm.
And there's not going to be a way to reconcile.
It's going
to
make a liar out of you.
So, for instance, one of the things that people do a lot is they use the Sodom and Gomorrah story mm-hmm. to oppress LGBTQ people
mm-hmm.
because there's a point in the story where they have these angels that have come to visit and they're locked up in the house and the town is an angry mob.
Yeah.
And they come and they say, bring them out so we can have sex with them. And it's men in the mob and the angels are masculine,
mm-hmm.
whatever. And so that's been used to say, all right, homosexuality is a sin,
mm-hmm.
you know, sodomy or Sodom and Gomorrah. Mm-hmm. That's how you connect mm-hmm. all of that
mm-hmm.
stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Never mind the fact that rape was about to happen. Never mind the fact that the issue was they were trying to rape somebody.
Yeah.
So you can use the Sodom story and try to say that with it. But then if you turn over to Ezekiel chapter 16, verse 46,
mm-hmm.
it tells you exactly what the problem was. It says, this was the guilt of your sister Sodom. You can't be more clear than that. This was the problem. She and her daughters had pride, excess food, and prosperous ease, but did not aid the poor and needy.
Mm-hmm.
Period. End of sentence.
That's it.
Nothing about sex.
Nope.
Nothing. They were gluttonous. They had all of this wealth. They didn't help the people who needed wealth.
They sound like some people I know.
And that is the issue with the city. That's why they got destroyed. So what I'm saying is the problem is when you start to try to pull things together, if you continue reading the Bible, you will find that somewhere else another writer came along mm-hmm. and explained something to you
mm-hmm.
that may undermine your efforts to oppress someone with this book. So
I mean, that kind of reminds me of even the movie, The Book of Eli. I feel like I've talked about this before. When you realize what book
mm-hmm.
the guy really wanted, he wanted it so that he could establish an oppressive system and back it up
with the Bible,
and God, I can do this way because God said so. And he wanted to be the only person who could, this is why I thought that movie was not brilliant, but I was just like,
it was brilliant.
I mean,
it was a brilliant movie.
Okay.
It was
all right.
About how
because
the
I felt like I was being extra,
people,
but
and what people will go through to oppress.
Right. But how differently abled people can actually be used in a way that is untouchable. Like for all the things that came up against this man, it's like when you look back in retrospect to the fact that this was a blind person doing this. I hope y'all saw it. But the point is, when you look back at how his different abilities protected his gift, and the gift was that his senses were so heightened that he was a warrior and he was thoughtful because he had to deal with people. He had to interact with people knowing that he was differently abled and also knowing that he could not let it be known that he could not see, you know, because that would have put his life in peril. But you want my book so bad, but you don't even speak my language because look at how I have to learn this book. So.
That movie makes me so happy. It's a brilliant movie.
Okay. Like, that's one of my thought favorites. I was being extra, but no. That's like one of my favorite movies.
No, it is. It is. Okay. So another thing we cannot do with the Bible, we cannot force people to live by it. No. Now, some people will say, no, we don't do that. But lots of people are trying to do that through legislation.
Yeah.
So they say, you know, these values that we hold, they come from this book. And we want to make sure that everyone lives according to these values because we believe that they are right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, once you start to get into that air quotes biblical space where you're saying this is biblical, what is biblical?
Exactly.
Is it the protecting children from abortion? That's not biblical. That's not in there. Is it slavery? Is that biblical? Because that's in there and right. It's endorsing it.
But it's not right.
Is it, you know, killing people to take over their land? That's biblical. So what?
So where
we talked about,
does this begin and end?
Yeah, marriage. There's no biblical marriage. There's all types of marriages in the Bible. So which one is the biblical one?
Mm-hmm.
So because of that complexity, you cannot use this to force people to do what you want them to do by using the, which is what they want to do in the book of Eli. I'm glad you brought that up. All right. Last thing that we cannot do with the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
We cannot dismiss it.
Ooh.
That is one thing. It's not going away.
Nope.
It is a cherished and valuable collection of people's history, people's story. And like any story, you want to make sure that you give that the proper weight, the proper respect.
Mm-hmm.
People died during the story. Actual people.
Yeah.
Whether the account that you're reading is the literal account of their death, blood was spilled for this story in many parts.
Yep.
This is a story of a people with rich history. This is a story that's relevant to us in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that if for those who really kind of like want to throw the whole thing away, you would be missing out on a lot of good information, a lot of good ideas about, you know, how to live and be and, you know, restore relationships.
I do think there's a lot of that, you know, not so much cancellation culture, but like throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah. Especially with this book because of the harm that's been done with this book.
But you have to do the painful work of separating those who benefited from the harm that tried to back it up with the book and why that was done. And if you do that level of review and study, you will find that as this particular system emerged, and this body of knowledge emerged, it gave a new opportunity for people to want to either control it or lead how it would be implemented.
Mm-hmm.
And that is probably one of the fatal flaws of humans, is that we are nihilistic and we try to determine not only how people will live, but how they will die.
Mm-hmm.
So here is a book that outlines life and death, you know, to say, oh, the power of life and death is in the tongue. It's also in the pen, because that is the different iteration of the tongue. It is also in our actions, because that is a different way to communicate. So this particular book, because of how important it was, and the fact that we had a major shift in world culture that amounts to, if you cannot beat them, join them, that lets you know that it was like, I don't want to make a bad analogy, but it's like it was popular. It was the Fortnite. It was the internet of its day.
Yeah.
And just like with
each story during the time.
Each story during that time, but even as you collect them, imagine the weight of seeing the 66 books that you finally decided do the best job of telling this cohesive story, and the people who just was trying to kill you in centuries 1, 2, and 3 were like, you know what? We can't even beat these like we can, cause love is so intoxicating, mm-hmm. and because feeling good about yourself is addictive, you know, or feeling like your children matter is just, I don't know, it makes you happier than you thought you could ever be. How do we join them? And imagine having to look at people that just, you know, 50 years ago, your grandfather was hiding in catacombs because he was trying to keep his life. And not only did he keep his life, but he is able to have a son, and his son had a son. And here you are. And now they're like, ta-da, you know, we are the blah, blah, blah. Oh, if you know history, you know what happened. But I mean, we can say that, like, it became the Roman Catholic Church. They went from like eating Christians with lions and chasing them down and stuff to, yeah, well, y'all like kings, we're going to put this Pope in place, and y'all not going to heaven unless he say so, you know, and just look at how that changed human history.
Yeah. We're still dealing with those.
We're
changes.
Still dealing with it, but you got to understand that even that co-opting of the Bible, things stand for generations and then they fall. Mm-hmm. That was literally the Roman Empire on its last leg. And it basically gave itself an IV through Christianity.
Yeah.
We might be on the dawn of another huge shift, but that shift is going to come from separating the Romans, the historical Romans, from the story that they tried to take as their own.
Yeah. So the Bible has been used for some horrific oppression and murder and land acquisition. And it's a tool. It's been used as a sword.
Mm-hmm.
And you can choose to say, I don't want anything to do with that sword. I'm not going to do that. But I would challenge you to look at that differently. Because money has also been used the same way.
Yep.
And ain't none of y'all opting out of money. So, do the work.
Do the work.
Stop using it as a sword and appreciate it for what it is. For Faith Uncut, I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
For more on Faith Uncut, check us out at faithuncut.com.